Okay, I believe the homework one solutions have been given. I put some up on the web page, but the others we just didn't get around to scanning them, so you have it in hard copy. The homework two is due next Monday, right? Next Monday. Just so you know, approximately, the idea is that we would have a midterm probably a week after next Monday, which is October 10th time frame. I'll give you an date, but the idea was that you will get done with homework two, I'll give you the solutions, and then we'll have midterm. Okay, the problem with midterm is I have to set it, which I don't know when I'm going to do it, but your midterm would approximately cover the first and second homeworks. I'll give you the exact date soon. Question? Yes, sir. I said that it was 26th October. Yeah, it's already been mentioned and it's been changed and it's been sent by email and everything. So it's 26th. Yeah. Other questions? Okay. So what I'm planning to do today is continue our discussion on clustering, which is basically today's would be the second clustering class, and then depending on how we do in time, I might move on from clustering to classification or text classification. We're looking at two long-standing machine learning problems, classification and clustering, except from the from the point of view of text, because that's what we are interested in. Okay, what we were talking about last time was the k-means algorithm. Do people remember what k-means is? Okay, and all we were doing was and we had this point about k-means has a reasonable amount of sensitivity to the initial seeds. Okay. In fact, k-means has lots and lots of problems. So, in fact, we'll start with a bunch of problems and solutions with respect to k-means. It's one of the easy algorithms to play with, and it can be, it's easy to run. It's, first of all, it's a local algorithm, so it just goes greedily towards clustering. And it also can be procedurally modified to take into account a variety of things. And then we would talk about some of those before we move on to another class of clustering algorithms called hierarchical clustering. Those are not by any means the only two types of clustering algorithms. It's just those are reasonable start. And in fact, there are much better ones. And the paper that you are supposed to have been reading, I'm assuming that I don't have to say read. When I say I'm going into this topic, then you look up the readings list for the topic, look at the primary paper, read it. Okay. So we are supposed to be reading the Steinbeck, Kumar et al. Paper. The only reason I picked that was A, it's short, B, it's in double spacing, so quite easy to read, and C, they actually compare a bunch of algorithms essentially based on k-means, variations, and hierarchical clustering in the context of text, which is nice. So in fact, we could make some, at least to the extent their study is definitive, you have some ideas about which algorithms are better. So let's talk about variations on k-means. So we already said, this is actually a simple improvement in k-means, which is that, remember the way k-means was going was you start with initial seeds. If you assume you're looking for k clusters, you pick k seeds. And then you have these two steps in each iteration. Step one is everybody goes to the mean, the center that is closest to them. Okay. Step two is the centers are recomputed. Okay. And then in the next iteration, the new centers will start the iteration. Everybody goes to the centers that are closest to them, and the centers are recomputed again. Okay. Now, in fact, this is the only main point. You have that all k-means have these two pieces. One is you recompute the centers based on the elements, and you reassign the elements based on the centers. So it's sort of a bootstrapping thing, and you do it until you cannot any longer change anything. And when that happens, you basically would have come to some local minimum. Okay, a local minimum in terms of intra-cluster distance, intra-cluster sum of squares distance, or maximum in terms of intra-cluster sum of similarities, squares of sum of similarities. Okay, having said that, now we look at variations for both these steps. The first thing, of course, is it's nice to think of these as two different steps, but as during the iteration, so suppose I started with two centers, okay, and now a lot of people actually started joining this center. Now you could actually change this center to reflect the current makeup of the cluster. K-means waits for the entire reassignment is over. The standard k-means waits until the entire reassignment is over before it resets the centers. But you can actually reset the centers every time a point changes allegiance. Okay. Now, if you are talking about resetting the centers using means, then you just do another arithmetic mean. You find another centroid. Now that one more new guy came, or one more old guy left, I recompute the centroid. Now, the difference is that this way, actually, the real centers will emerge much faster. Okay, so if, in fact, in the beginning of the iteration itself, a large number of people found their right centers, and you took that into account by recomputing the centers, the rest of the people actually have the right centers, the accurate centers of the two clusters. So they don't have to make any false moves, obviously. Okay, so this is something that you can do, and in fact, I sent a nice mail, a long mail a couple of days back on this idea and how that can be modified into some yet another different algorithm, which is called self-organizing maps. Okay, but I won't go that into that. If you're interested, go back and read that email. But this is a reasonable efficiency hack from the point of view of k-means. It actually improves the convergence speed. It has to, because it increases the per iteration cost, but it reduces the number of iterations. And to the extent that the initial joining points are already, the big difference might very well be made by the initial points that get into the cluster. So, for example, if you remember, I'm sure there was some example somewhere. Okay. So notice that here, unfortunately, we started with these two as the cluster centers. But as you start making, assignments of points to these, okay, you would very quickly see, even after a couple of points, if you are lucky, for example, suppose you started assigning a couple from here and a couple from here. I mean, in this case, you're seeing it. But even if you randomly pick, there's a chance that you'll pick some from here and some from here, and assigning them to their closest centers. The moment you do that, you start realizing that one of these guys is actually being pulled this direction. And if you recompute the center at that point of time, then the center would have actually come here. And then it becomes much easier for the rest of the points to find their true leader for the cluster center. Okay? So that makes the convergence faster. Okay. The other thing is this whole issue of centroids. This is an efficiency hack. This is a bigger problem. Starting initial centroids make a big difference. Okay, and if you pick the wrong ones, you might well wind up with suboptimal clusters. Suboptimal clusters, even among the clusters that k-means could have found. That's all I'm saying. Okay, so if you started from somewhere else, so in fact, there's another mail I sent with respect to the grades, midterm grades. And if you spend time looking at it, you would realize that just changing reasonable centroids, initial centroids, would lead you to completely different clustering. And sometimes the clusters are very, very unstable with respect to just minor changes. Okay? So that's an important problem. Okay? And also actually it turns out that it's also connected to the rate of convergence, but it's more important. The rate of convergence part should be clear. In the previous picture that you saw, had you taken one point from here and one point from here as the cluster center, clearly you would have, I mean, if you lucked out and started with representative points in the clusters as the cluster centers, then you are more likely to actually converge faster than if you put all the cluster centers in one actual, one final cluster. Then they all have to move to their right place. Okay? So the basic idea is you use all sorts of heuristics to pick good seeds. And one idea is actually this, which is you could, for example, I mean, one idea would be to use a cheap clustering over some random sample. Okay? So basically you would take a random sample of the data, a small sample of the data. Do some other clustering. Find out what are the clusters in the random sample. Use that to figure out where are the right centers. In fact, we will talk about an algorithm like this called HACC. It looks like a hack, and it's in fact, we'll look at hybrid agglomerative clustering algorithm. I think it's HACC or Buckshot. No, sorry, it's Buckshot. An algorithm called Buckshot, which basically uses a hierarchical clustering algorithm on a small sample and uses that to pick the centers for any k-means, for any value of k. And then you can use that to run the k-means. So that's a general idea, that's a special case of this general idea. You know, use some other prior knowledge or use some extra work upfront to come up with reasonable centers and then use them as the input for the k-means. The other thing, of course, you could do, which we already said, is run k-means m times and pick the clustering, the best clustering that results. Okay, you can always do that. Okay, and in fact, bisecting k-means is actually, which is an idea that we looked at towards the end of last class, and I'm just going back a little bit, is exactly done that, used that idea. What it did was, it was basically splitting, always splitting a cluster into two clusters. So it has in front of it some set of clusters. It picks one of them and splits it into two clusters. Only two. Okay? So it has two choices. Choice one is which of the clusters in front of it does it pick. And choice two is which are the centroids, which are the two centroids it would use to actually split this cluster. And for the choice one, in fact, this paper actually talks about bisecting k-means, and they look at variations, lots and lots of various ways of picking the best cluster. For example, you can pick as the cluster the loosest cluster. I mean, if you think the best cluster is the tightest one, in the sense that the sum of their distances from the centroid is minimized, okay, then the ones which are loose are actually easy to split. I mean, they should probably be split. Okay? And so that's one idea. The other idea is just take the biggest cluster. You know, just look at the largest cluster and try to split it. Okay? And they actually say that both ideas work just as well, and so they wind up pick the largest cluster and split it. Okay? Having done that, then you have a single cluster in front of you that you have decided to split. Now you want to split it the best way possible. Okay? So what you would like to do is, for some number of iterations, you would split C into C1 and C2. Okay, so you call k-means as a subroutine for some number of iterations. Okay, each time you pick different centroids and you run k-means. And when k-means converges, you know the two clusters, two partitions. Basically, these are partitions of C. Okay, so they're two partitions of C. And you look at all these two partitions and see which is the best. Now, you know how to compute which is the best. The idea would be to take the clusters, a cluster is considered best if, in fact, the intra-cluster sum of distances is minimum. Okay, or equivalently, the intra-cluster sum of similarities is maximum. So you have common currency in which to compute. So C is made into C1, C2, C1 dash, C2 dash, C1 double dash, C2 double dash, and for each of them there is a single metric that you are computing, and whichever number is the best, you pick that as the cluster. Okay, now this brings up the issue of, since in fact, you know, I'm sort of going at conceptual level as to how these algorithms would work, and if you're actually implementing these algorithms, you want to be efficient in terms of computing some of these distances. Okay, and also computing the, for example, the cluster similarity. You know, you could do, basically all I'm saying is, you know, for each point in the cluster, you compute its distance from either the center or from every other point and take the average or the sum. Okay, I actually stuck to one simple idea, which was for each cluster, take the, if I don't say anything else, you can assume that the way I would compute the cluster goodness is to take the cluster centroid, take the distance of each point from the cluster centroid, square it, sum it all up. That would be the sum of squares distance from the centroid of each cluster. But that's just one idea. You could do many other ways. Okay, for example, I could also have considered for every point in the cluster, for every pair of points in the cluster, compute the distance. Take the average. In a good cluster, that average would be small. Agreed? In a good cluster, somehow. Again, remember that whenever we are saying that, we are sort of thinking of clusters which are tight, and everybody's favorite way of looking at clusters that are tight is like a ball, which is actually a feature as well as a bug of k-means algorithm. It will try to find you spherical clusters. If what you actually have are clusters that are linear, you know, chains, it will still find you spheres on them. Okay, so one of the things is it's biased to find spherical clusters, so it might actually miss the linear clusters. For example, it might take a long chain cluster, split it into two clusters. Okay, but having said that, you have this issue of computing the, let's say the similarity between the goodness of a cluster, and one is, of course, as I said, similar, the goodness of a cluster is in terms of centroid and the distance from the centroid. The other, I said, is consider the average of all the pairs of distances. Now, upfront, it does look like that's a bad idea, right? Upfront, it looks like you have n square distances to compute and add them all up. And once in a while, for the right combination of the distance metric and the right combination of the cluster similar to cluster goodness metric, you might actually luck out. And here is the reason I want to show this is actually discussed in the paper, and it's like a neat point, which basically says that if you were to find average similarity between all pairs of points in a cluster, if you want to find that, there's a hard way to do it, there's an easy way to do it. Hard way is do the n square computation. Easy way is take the centroid, square it. Okay, a little bit of, you know, simplification goes a long way. Because you can let the computer do the simplification, or you can do it with your head, and if you do it, you know, it makes a lot of a difference. So, one, the reason I brought this up is twofold. One is, this is kind of a neat idea. So here, for example, for every D and D dash belonging to some set of points, right, I'm taking the sum of the cosine distances, which is based on, these are cosine distances are based on dot products. They have some nice properties, it turns out. Okay, so that you're basically taking a dot product of D and D dash and D, and then you want to take the average, so you sum them all up and divide it by the square of the size of the element, because there will be n square combinations. Okay, now it turns out that you can actually write this as 1 by s times sigma of D dot 1 by s times sigma of D, which is a centroid here and a centroid here. So a centroid is being dotted with itself. If you dot the centroid, if you take the dot product of a vector with itself, you actually get the square of its norm. Okay. Now notice that had I taken Euclidean distance instead of dot product distance, this nice simplification wouldn't have occurred. So sometimes people play these games, you know, you're okay. As far as you are concerned, it doesn't matter to you whether I define cluster goodness in terms of centroid to element distances or whether I define it this way. Both of them look reasonable to you. So I pick this in this paper, actually they pick this because that's actually cheaper, much cheaper to compute. It looks harder, but it's actually cheaper. Nice point. Okay. In fact, this other one basically says that the similarity between a document and the centroid is equal to the average similarity between that document and every other document. That's probably easier to see coming. Okay, but these are properties that hold mostly because the distance metric is defined in terms of dot product. You could define distance metric in any which way. You could do logarithms, squares, and cubes, and k-means will still work. But if you do it this way, certain nice properties will hold. Okay? And in clustering algorithms in general, people make these kinds of arbitrary choices in favor of one as against other of many reasonable definitions of intra-cluster similarity or inter-cluster dissimilarity. And until now, we didn't talk about inter-cluster dissimilarity. When we go into hierarchical clustering, that becomes front and center, we'll see. And then you do remember that if you have two clusters, there are many, many ways in which you can define distance between two clusters. Is that the distance between the centroids? Is it the closest distance between any two points? Is it the farthest distance between any two points? Is it the average distance between all pairs of points? All of them are reasonable definitions. And they all lead to different behaviors, in fact. Okay, but I brought this up partly because they're beneath the hood when we are just saying find the best. You actually have to compute this cluster goodness, and if you're computing it multiple times, you better use the metric that is cheaper to compute. Okay, and in fact, the paper that you read doesn't make any bones about it. It says we like cosine theta metric and k means. Because they have certain advantageous properties, okay? And then the reason I mentioned means as if that's also up for grabs is coming up in a minute. Even the means part of k-means is up for grabs, as you can see here, okay? Another problem with k-means is outliers. So you might have, let's say, a nice class, in the original data, there may be a nice clump of points here, a nice clump of points here, and there's one point up there. Since k-means is an exhaustive method, it must have everybody assigned to clusters, right? Because of that one guy, you might wind up having weird looking clusters. Because wherever that guy is, just to keep that guy in, the mean has to travel a lot. We deal with this problem in real life. You know, just to keep Bill Gates as part of US, the annual salary of people has to be much higher. So as not to make us depressed, we talk about median income. Never talk about mean income of US people, because the mean income, unfortunately, is affected by Bill Gates' income as well as those four guys in Ninth Ward of New Orleans. Okay? Median, on the other hand, is stable with respect to outliers, if you want to call these outliers. Okay? So you could actually define a version of k-means called k-medoids. I mean, so k-medians, but it doesn't have the same thing in it. So it's a k-medoid. Just like there's a centroid for a set of vectors, there's a medoid for a set of vectors. Okay. You could do that, and you could do the same exact thing with respect to medoids. What's the problem with k-medoids? It actually is insensitive to outliers. Much less sensitive to outliers. I mean, you learned about medians because they are insensitive to outliers. We use median incomes because they are insensitive to outliers. Okay, that's like the 101 of means medians, right? What's the problem? From a computer science point of view, why do people wince when they hear the word median? Median involves essentially part of sorting. You don't have to do the full sorting, but it's not like just adding up numbers and dividing it by n. Okay, so median anything is harder. In fact, one of the things that people do in image processing sorts of applications is things like median filtering, which is if you take a block, remember in the vector quantization we took a block and you decided the block is represented by its centroid. Now, you could represent a block by its median. It's called median filtering. And nobody uses it because it's too costly to implement. It's too costly to have special purpose hardware for that. It's harder compared to mean-based anything. Okay? But people have used k-meroid-style algorithms. And nothing changed other than the fact that each cluster is now based, the representative of the cluster is no longer the centroid, but the meroid. And the distances, everything remain the same. Okay, but some of those nice properties that we talked about, for example, that the distance of a point from every other point in the cluster, the average distance of a point from every other point in the cluster, is no longer related to its distance to the meroid, while it is related to the distance to the centroid. Okay, so that's the k-meroid. There is, as I said, it's costly. There's another variation called in essence, sometimes, remember in clustering algorithms, we talked about hard versus soft clusters in the very beginning. Should each point be part of a single cluster or could it be part of multiple clusters? Okay. Oftentimes, there are points that are partially part of multiple clusters. And you would like to take that into account. Okay. And the way you would do that essentially is a variation of k-means called soft k-means. And all that soft k-means does is it provides for each point a membership in all the clusters. But it's really a vector of membership such that the vector adds up to 1 and individual cluster membership is higher if you really belong to that level. So one obvious idea is this membership. So during some iteration of k-means, there's a point and it has like 3 cluster centers staring at it. It's trying to decide which side to go. So you could say my attraction to this is based on my distance to this. My attraction to this is based on my distance to this. My attraction to this is based on my distance to this. So make a metric which is inversely proportional to your distance. Okay, that would tell you your attraction to each of the centers. That's your vector of membership. If you look at it from that point of view, what k-means is doing is it is making that vector and then it's ignoring everything other than the maximum. So whichever is the center that is attracting you maximally, you go join that cluster. That's it. So if this center is attracting you 0.500000001 and the other one is attracting you 0.4999999, you join this one because it's 0.500. Because that's it. Okay. Instead, you could keep the vector around. And you can say that this point really legitimately belongs to both this cluster and this cluster. It belongs to this cluster 0.5, I mean 50% to this cluster, 50% to this cluster. And some other point might belong to 90% to this cluster, 10% to this cluster. Now, the advantage of this is actually sometimes in terms of the way the k-means will actually converge is also affected if you consider the fact that points might have multiple cluster memberships. Why? Because when you are recomputing centers for each cluster, you are only considering those guys who are part of your cluster already. Previously, suppose there were 2 points. This point was like this point was 0.5001 to this and 0.499 to this. Another point was just the opposite of those 2 numbers. Now, these 2 both have effect on both the clusters. And yet, when you recompute the center, you're only considering 1 of these points in each cluster. Okay. So all we would do is when we are computing the new means, you consider for each point, basically you take a weighted mean. Instead of normal mean, normal centroid, you take a weighted centroid, where the weight is provided by the membership. That's all. Okay? And this winds up having an interesting difference if in fact the original clusters were formed by processes that have obvious overlap to begin with. You know, those of you, for example, suppose you have the data points were formed by one normal distribution centered here and another normal distribution centered here. Now, normal distributions basically are normal distributions. They can actually, even though you are centered here, you can produce data points that far away. With low probability, you can produce them. So the original cluster, the original generative process that generated the data was actually overlapping. And yet, you are trying to cut and say, this must be disjoint from this. And obviously, you lose some of the structure of the data. Soft k-means, in essence, tries to get that back. Okay, and in fact, if you understand what soft k-means is doing, in terms of, there's a nice way of explaining what k-means is doing in terms of mixture of Gaussians generating the data. So if you assume that the original data has been generated by k Gaussians centered at various means, okay, with each of them with a different variance. Now, what k-means is trying to do, what you're trying to do in the clustering phase is to recover for each cluster the parameters, the mean and the variance. Okay, that makes a lot of sense. You know, you are essentially assuming that somebody made this data, and all I'm trying to do in clustering is to read the mind of the process which made the data. And if it is a Gaussian which made the data, then, you know, a Gaussian is determined by two parameters. Now, in k-means, in normal k-means, we are only caring about the mean, which means we are assuming that the variances are all the same. That's why if you're ignoring it, that means it doesn't matter. That means you're indifferent to it. That means it's the same. Okay? By the time you came here, in soft k-means, you are still only caring about the means, but you are considering the fact that a point can correspond to multiple clusters. And a variation of this would actually also compute, would also allow you to estimate the variances. Okay, and that's basically the first algorithm that people describe when they describe a general class of algorithms called expectation maximization, for those of you who know that term. May or may not get to that. But it's a nice connection to the fact that we are looking for clusters without caring about who generated this data. Sometimes you might try to make assumptions on who generated the data, what process generated the data. And if you make those assumptions, then clustering would be essentially trying to recover those parameters of the process which generated the data. Okay? Now, each of these changes are little changes to k-means, not that hard. But it's an easy algorithm to vary, you know, and lots of variations have been done, okay? And actually, although I won't go into too much detail into this, but in fact, one way you might know information about your data would be that I don't know really what clusters are definitely there in this data, but I do know some extra information than the fact that the data is there. Okay, I might know, for example, let's say that the data in front of you has been taken from two news groups. Okay, comp.ai and comp.net software engineering. Hopefully it is joined. Okay, and so now try to cluster. How could you use that? You set k equal to 2, because there are two news groups, so at least start with k equal to 2. Okay, the other thing I'll say is, not only that, I can tell you that these two documents are AI. These two documents are software engineering. This and this really are not in the same class. So I'm giving you partial labeling. Okay, if I give you partial labeling of the data points, right, and I'm still asking you to cluster the rest of the ones that you don't have labels for. That's still clustering, except it's clustering with more data than what we started with previously, which is just the data itself. Okay? It turns out that k-means can be easily modified to handle those kinds of constraints. Okay, there are lots and lots of variations, lots and lots of small papers, which essentially tell you, for example, basically much of the time what winds up changing is at the time when you are assigning data points to clusters, previously all that you cared about is what is the distance of this data point to various cluster centers. And whichever is the closest, you just go through it in there. Okay. Now you might know that this data point cannot live with this other data point, which is already part of this cluster. So even though I feel attracted to the center, I have also my enemy in this, so I go sit in this other cluster. Not that hard. Essentially, it's just a couple of lines change to the k-means algorithm. Okay. So go with the minimum distance unless there's a constraint which stops you from doing so. Okay, and then same way, as soon as somebody has been assigned to a cluster, everybody who that point is supposed to go along with, they all can be right away assigned to that cluster without worrying about where they're supposed to go. Okay, so it just changes the, basically you're introducing more input into the k-means iteration. And obviously the clusters that you get would be consistent with the constraints that you are biasing, but you're biasing yourself with. Okay? So in fact, this idea is called semi-supervised clustering. And in general, actually, in the kind of applications that you find for clustering in text data, you do have this kind of scenario. So normally I might give you, okay, here are, you know, articles taken from multiple news groups. And I can tell you how many news groups I took them from. And I might also tell you, in the beginning, I might also tell you these, you know, groups, these, some of these articles, I know for sure where they came from. And using that, I'm trying to find clustering of entire data set. Okay? So that would be semi-supervised version. And then the point I'm trying to make here, of course, is you can actually take those kinds of constraints easily by just changing the innards of the k-means. And innards of k-means is a big word, but really k-means only has two steps. And those are the only two things one of them has to change. Either you change the centroid initialization, or you change the way things are assigned to the center. And normally people play with those kinds of algorithms, which are simple, so you look for 10 variations of that. Okay. Questions on that stuff? Okay. Those are all variations, and in fact, in some sense, you know, there are not enough pictures there, but I was trying to tell you that from a simple idea, you can actually extend it in multiple directions to more, possibly more interesting clustering applications, okay, depending on you what you're trying to cluster. Now we'll look at a slightly different algorithm called hierarchical clustering, which does not ask you how many clusters am I supposed to find. K means whatever you do, will always ask you how many clusters am I supposed to find. And if you don't know that, then it's guessing. Okay, the way hierarchical clustering basically works is it just divides the data, make it into a big hierarchy. Now, when you have a hierarchy like this, right, so on the top, the data has been divided into this part and that part. Okay, and if you come here, the data has been divided into this part and this part. Now, how many pieces has the data been divided into? That makes no sense. You can tell me how many pieces you want the data to be in, and I'll get you that number. Okay, suppose you want me to give you two, I'll say, well, the two are, this is one set, that's another set. You want three? Yeah, I'll give you three. This is one set, this is one set, this is another set. So I just start from here, keep going down until the number of lines I cross is equal to k, and I'll give you that k. Okay? And the other nice thing is it looks as if somebody carefully organized the data into a hierarchy. Now, hierarchies are good stuff for us. We like hierarchies. We always organize data, you know, knowledge into hierarchies. And so we tend sometimes to overload all the good things that we associate with hierarchies to hierarchies that are generated by an algorithm, which might actually have no significance. Okay, for example, This particular kind of hierarchy is called a dendrogram. So at every level you are splitting into two. Okay, it's called a dendrogram. Now it turns out that in biology, oftentimes a lot of knowledge is normally organized into dendrograms. So in fact, they talk about the evolutionary path to us. Okay, and you can say from some common ancestor, you split into this, this, and then this guy split into this, this, then this guy split into this and this. And then you can talk about how close are various animals to us in this dendrogram. Okay? So it looks like evolution knowledge, the way the species evolved can be represented as a dendrogram. Now, that means that when I'm trying to cluster some data about evolutionary genomics, it looks as if the nice thing to do is find a dendrogram. The dendrogram you find may actually wind up putting you close to horse as against to monkey. Okay, and Darwin might, you know, not be happy, but he's dead. The point, of course, is it looks at least like the solution is supposed to look. It's like a good paper must have clear plastic binding, so I'll first buy the clear plastic binding and then start thinking about what to write inside the paper. So a good clustering in genomics might be a dendrogram, so I'll just go look for a dendrogram. Okay. In fact, the reason I'm saying this is in various applications where people like hierarchical clustering, oftentimes they are overloading their biases about what, you know, is the best form to organize knowledge in. Okay, and then using that to say, oh, anything which produces hierarchy must be good. Okay, and say you won't read this in textbooks. This is obviously a opinion that I'm expressing to you, but you took a course with me, so you have to listen to my opinion. So there are all the problems that k-means has with hierarchical the hierarchical clustering algorithm. It's just that sometimes people just go with that because, you know, you have this. So for example, if I am trying to split you into five grades, then I just say, wow, k-means is like tailor-made for me. That's not true. You guys saw that. That was, you know, k-means is not any more tailor-made than any other clustering algorithm. It's just that it looks as if that will take k equal to 5 and give me 5 clusters, so I don't have to worry about one more issue. Okay, and then I can say computer did it. And the same way here, computer did a dendrogram for me. Okay. So that's your finally every hierarchical clustering provides a dendrogram like this. You have seen a hierarchical clustering algorithm by now. Which one is it? Bisecting k-means. What it did actually was it started from the top, split into two, took one, split into two, took one, split into two, and so on. So it's actually generating, in some cases it generated a dendrogram. Okay, when everything is connected. Okay? Now, in fact, that is basically called divisive hierarchical clustering because it divides, starts from the top and divides. Okay? So you can have an opposite of it, and it should have as good a name, and so we call it agglomerative hierarchical clustering. So you basically start at the bottom, you say everybody is their own cluster. So initially, so for example, in this particular case, by the way, in case it wasn't obvious to you, these guys are the points themselves. These are the data points. The maximum number of clusters you can find is the number of data points, as long as, you know, each point can only be in exactly one cluster, which is what we're still using. Okay, so you start from here and you are trying to combine like clusters. So in each iteration, what hierarchical agglomerative clustering does is it looks at all the clusters in front of it, finds the pair of clusters that are closest to each other, and say, since you love each other so much, ye shall become a super cluster. Okay? And so in the next iteration, there is one less cluster because these two guys became one cluster. And now in the next iteration, you'll again look at all the clusters, one of which happens to be a super cluster, and ask which pair of clusters are closest to each other. And then take that pair, make it into a supercluster. So in this particular case, what might have happened is that I picked, in the first iteration, I might have picked 8A and 8A, in which case that was a cluster. In the second iteration, maybe I picked 1 and 6, that became a cluster. And at some point of time, I picked the cluster of 8 and 8A and 7 because those wound up being the closest in that iteration. And so I made them into a cluster. That's all. That's what is hierarchical agglomerative clustering. There was only one point that you need to understand here. One point, which is everything else is things like finding the closest pair. There's some data structures involved. You should do it efficiently. Okay? You should keep them nicely sorted and find quickly what is the closest pair. But there is another point, which is actually more problem specific, which is what are closest clusters? Given two clusters, which are given five clusters, which two are closest? To do that, you have to say the distance between a pair of clusters. That can be defined in multiple ways. Distance between pair of clusters can be defined in multiple ways. Based on the way you define the distance between the clusters. I'm not talking about the distance. Remember at one time I pointed out that k-means can have different answers based on the distance measure you use. You could use vector-based similarity. You could use Jaccard similarity. You could use vector-based similarity power 3 by 2. Okay, all these are different distance metrics. Okay, and then k-means will change. But that's domain knowledge. You're changing what it means for two data points to be similar. I'm asking a different question now. What does it mean? Assuming that I've already decided what it means for two data points to be similar, what does it mean for two clusters to be similar? So that has to be somehow connected to the data point distances. And we mentioned that there are multiple ways of doing it. So you could talk about the distance between the two closest points, the distance between the two farthest points, the average distance between pairs, all pairs, where one from here and one from here, are the distance between the centroids. They're all different metrics. Now the question is, which one is the right one? And as I said, in fact, first of all, I want to show you that the difference matters in terms of the clusters you will wind up producing. Okay? Let's look at this data. Okay? So what am I doing here? I'm trying to find first a pair of points. So these are all the points, and I'm assuming that the distance is Euclidean distance. Okay? So what would I start by clustering first? Which pair would you pick if you were to pick the two? I mean, each point right now is both a point and a cluster. It's a singleton cluster. So tell me which two pair of clusters would you start? I mean, if there are equally good ones, pick one, basically. So for example, would you ever pick this and this as the first pair of clusters? Of course not. This is one, this is one, that is one, that is one. They're all equidistant clusters. So in fact, I would argue that in essence, you could basically pick any of them. In the first four iterations, you'll pick one at a time. Okay? So you now have four clusters. Okay? And at this point, you have to pick a pair of clusters that you should combine. At this point, you should pick a pair of clusters that you should combine. How do you define the distance between clusters? I would say right now let's go with the closest two points. The distance between the two closest points in the two clusters is the distance between them. This is like the weakest link in the chain kind of an idea. Okay, so based on that, what would you say? For these, the distance would be that. For these, the distance would be that. For these, the distance would be either of those because those two are same. And that would be that. Now, just eyeballing it, which looks smaller? Does it look like these two would have smaller distance or those two would have smaller distance? These two. So if you go with single link, which is basically the technical name for the weak, taking the two points which are closest to each other, then you would do that as the cluster, that as the cluster. At this point, there are only two clusters. You combine them into a super cluster. So the data is all organized into a big cluster. At the second level, it's organized into these two clusters. At the third, that cluster has been then organized into these two. That cluster has been organized into these two. Okay? That's hierarchical agglomerative clustering working. There's one small point which I should mention, which is that it's not necessary that, in fact, I started here, and I asked first time when I asked about question about what is the distance between clusters is, I already put these clusters like this. But actually, I'm sorry. Consider the point when you have just made these two into a cluster. You still have the second iteration now. At the second iteration, you are actually considering any pair of these clusters. Okay, this is a cluster, this is a cluster. So if you're using single link, then the distance between this cluster and this is that. I actually do that. I just went into the four clusters thing to make the explanation simpler. But really, you handle clusters of different sizes at each iteration. A cluster is a cluster. Okay? And all you care about single link is the smallest, the pair with the shortest distance between them. So that's what you would have done if you did single link for that. And can you actually see that you would do something different if you were to use the distance measure to be the maximum between the two clusters instead of the minimum between the two clusters? Okay? So what happens this time is essentially you would be fine until the first four. And at this point, you are now, the distance between these two is not that, but it's that. So suddenly they no longer are as attracted to each other. This guy looks at here, the distance between these two is basically this, because that's the same distance. I'm sorry, actually, in fact, the distance between those two would be that, the diagonal. Still cheaper than that. Okay, so what do? You combine those two. So you wind up changing the clustering. Okay, yes, sir. Which one? In this example, right? So you're saying, well, the point is, this is a cluster of one point, this is a cluster of one point, right? To get the vertical thing, this cluster should feel that it's closer to this than this. No. So here's the thing. Think about this. This is the min over max. Okay, given two clusters, the distance between them is the maximum distance between any two. And if you give me three clusters, if you give me, you know, here's cluster one, cluster two, cluster three, then the distance between this and this is in terms of max, between this and this is in terms of max, right? But it would feel that the closest neighbor is whichever is the one with the lower distance, min over max. Okay, a good so it's like the way you change, what you change is the notion of distance between two clusters. But clusters always want to be close to each other before they're combined. Now, the point to understand is both of these are reasonable ideas. Both of these are reasonable ideas, and they just actually lead to different shaped clusters. Okay? If you use single link, you're likely to find clusters that are elongated. Because if you have one cluster which is like this and another cluster which is like that, they're actually close because their closest points are close. I remember all the discussion I did about how students want their grades to be clustered and how the teachers want to do their clustering. Students want the grades to be clustered in a single link fashion. Okay? And because of which everybody would get A, you know, if you ever make a mistake of giving anybody an A. And the teachers, on the other hand, looking at the maximum distance. They would rather not anybody fall, because then, especially given falling enrollment, we want you to hang around for longer and longer time to take the classes. But anyway, the question as to what is the right distance measure is really based on what you think are the kinds of clusters you're supposed to find. Now, having said that, it turns out that different people wind up taking either single link or max link, not based on what is the right thing to do, but based on what would wind up being easier for the algorithm. Okay, it's like doing AVL trees versus binary trees, not based on whether AVL trees is a better idea than binary trees, but based on which will take more lines of code to write. And of course, all of us thought, you know, data structure should end on the day binary trees were over, because AVL trees is such a mess. and you know, all this height balancing, etc., what a pain. And nobody is trying to make you happy, unfortunately. So the point I'm trying to make here is, in fact, the right way to define the distance between clusters is actually domain dependent. But once there is a choice, people try to make that choice to make themselves happy. If you can't make the domain be happy, at least you be happy. So, you know, there are cases where, in fact, using max as the distance winds up having certain good properties for the algorithm, not for the data. So I'll just use max. Okay, those of you who are also sitting in the other class this morning know that if you have the must not link constraint and you wound up defining intra-cluster distance in terms of min, the whole thing collapses. So you better define it in terms of max, even if in fact your domain is full of link, you know, chain-shaped clusters. Okay, this is that last three sentences, people, not everybody needs to understand. That's okay. Okay, so that's basically hierarchical agglomerated clustering, and the fact that the way you define the inter-cluster distance makes a difference. And those are only two. And in fact, you can also have pairs of points taken from each cluster and taking their distances and averaging them out. That's a reasonable thing too. In fact, I think the paper actually uses that as the metric when it was doing clustering in the hierarchical agglomerated clustering. Look at the paper going back, and they actually look at three variations of hierarchical agglomerated clustering. And the variations all depend on how you define the cluster distance. Okay. So that's all summary of what I just said. Okay. And then it is deterministic, modulo tie breaking, it runs in n square time, okay, because it's looking at pairs. Okay, at the lowest level it's looking at pairs of data points. Okay. And then for a while, apparently, for text data at least, people used to think, according to this paper that you were to read, that hierarchical clustering is nicer. And these guys now point out that, in fact, k-means and bisecting k-means are better. Now, how do I describe what is better? As I said, there are two ways of talking about goodness of clusters. One is internal, how nice and shiny are they? I mean, how tight are they? How far away from each other are they? And the external, which is, what do the users think about these clusters? Okay? And if the user thinks these points should not be in this cluster with these other points, then that's bad. So they actually use entropy measures, again, read the paper, to talk about, given entropy measures are basically like precision recall based. If the user says this should have been part of this cluster and you didn't put it, you get a slap on the wrist. Okay? If the user says this is supposed to be part of the other cluster and you put it here, you get yet another slap on the wrist. And you're counting all the slaps and saying, you know, the cluster that's the best clustering is the one with the least number of slaps. You can measure that using entropy or anything, using precision. Basically, the precision recall are connected to, if we're supposed to be in this cluster and you didn't put it in, what did you lose? You lost recall with respect to this cluster. And it's not supposed to be in this cluster and you put it in, what did you lose? You lost precision with respect to this cluster. And this is why they wind up talking about precision recall and a combined measure, which is a harmonic mean of precision and recall to compare clusters. Actually, you should read that paper and ask yourself, are they doing it right? In fact, they actually compare a bunch of algorithms on a bunch of text databases and come to a bunch of conclusions. And I want you to think about and tell me next week, if you remember, could you have done something different and probably gotten completely different answers? Because there's so many parameters that they can be tweaking. Okay, including the definition of what is goodness of a cluster. Okay. So we talked about bisecting k-means, which is basically an example of divisive hierarchical clustering. One last one that I want to talk about is the Buckshot algorithm, which essentially uses hierarchical agglomerative clustering on a small piece of the data. Okay, on a small piece of the data. Okay, and then that will tell you like a rough clustering of the data. And then using that, it figures out the centers for the number of clusters that you're asking me. Then it does k-means on that. Why do they do it? Part of it is hierarchical clustering is n squared, k-means is n. okay? And so you try to avoid n squared. So what do they do here? They take a square root n sample from the data. Why was square root n? What's important about it? If you square it becomes n. Okay, right? So you take square root n samples from the original data randomly. Okay, and that's supposed to be a random representative of the original data. Then do hierarchical clustering on it. You'll only have done square root n square work, which is only n work. And you'd have gotten a nice little hierarchical clustering like this. Then you can, and then your friend now is basically saying, I want to really do k-means clustering on this with k equal to 7. I'm sorry, so we started disturbing people outside now, I think. I should put a note next time. What you do to actually reduce the number of, to get the k, the number of, if you know k is, let's say in this particular case, what am I doing? In this particular case, if I take k equal to, if I want three clusters, then essentially this is one cluster, this is one cluster, this is another cluster. To the extent this is a random sample, the centroids of these three clusters would also be the right centroids for the entire data. So you start those as the centroids. So you take the centroid for 1 and 5, centroid for all these points, centroid for all those points. You get three different centroids. You give that as the initial seed for k-means. It's called buckshot algorithm. The number of variations of k-means and hierarchical k-means is so large that there are textbooks written on clustering, most of which just talk about k-means and hierarchical k-means. But the main ideas have been discussed in clustering. Okay. And then the last part that I want to do, although I've been doing it in the background, is text clustering. And you know, how do you actually apply this stuff to text clustering and what winds up being better? Now the answer to that is made hard by the fact that these are not even the only two families of algorithms. There are tons of other families of clustering algorithms. And really the answer is not known as to what is the best. And so in fact you can go and take algorithm A and algorithm A dash and compare it on database D5. And see which does better. Okay, and one of the nice things in this is its choice depends on what are the two algorithms and what is the data set. Right? You can use, and if one of the data algorithms that you're comparing is yours, you want your algorithm to win. Right? So, in fact, there is a hilarious paper whose link I'll send you. It's from the same Journal of Machine Learning Gossip, from where you heard about how to get 100% precise search in web pornography search. Okay, so there they talk about this idea called data set selection problem. And seriously, they actually, it's like Radio Shakespeare Company. If you understand the theory, you'll find the joke much more interesting. Okay, so they're talking about, given my algorithm and some algorithms that I want to win over, and I have lots and lots of data sets, how would I pick the right data set to maximize the chance that my algorithm would be shown to be the best? Okay, and I'll send you that link, and you should learn that because it's important stuff. But anyway, having said that, if you take it less cynically, assume that there are some benchmarks, and you're trying to compare different clustering algorithms on these benchmarks. Which one is working well? And first of all, how would you do clustering? And the biggest issue is when you're doing clustering is what's the distance? And we already know that for text, there are multiple distances, okay? Normally, people seem to use normalized TF-IDF metrics. But if their life can be made simpler by using something else, they'll use it, okay? And nobody really cares about what distance they're using. But I think for text, oftentimes, something related to TF-IDF-based metric is what's used, okay? And then, of course, you have to consider optimizations of computations over sparse vectors, part of it, because you have distances over this text document. That's useful. And then finally, in terms of applications, you kind of know that clustering can be used in multiple places. You can do it during retrieval. I mentioned this in the beginning of clustering. I'm just mentioning it at the end again. You can do it during retrieval. When you present the results, you can quickly cluster them. Okay, and then show those clusters, and then that kind of, And if to the extent the user sees similar results clustered together, that's like three clusters as against 30 results, which might be easier. Okay. That's one aspect. And of course, you can also oftentimes want to find clustering over large number of text documents into groups. For example, if these were from different news groups, how would I find which group it might have come from? Okay. And then, of course, because you have hierarchical clustering, you could try to hope that if you do some sort of a hierarchical clustering, then you might find something like Yahoo directory. Because that's a hierarchy. I'll get a hierarchy if I run a hierarchical clustering. So it's like the final document is supposed to have a clear plastic cover. If I do this, I'll have a clear plastic cover. So maybe that will be the answer. It turns out it's not a great idea. You know, in fact, nobody has shown that doing hierarchical clustering on text data will provide the kind of hierarchical taxonomies that people would find useful. But if you want some sort of a hierarchical storage mechanism for bunches of data, then you could do it that way. Okay. One interesting thing is, in fact, you could try this. One interesting thing about this is, what would you say is the description of interior nodes in the hierarchy? So, for example, if you go back to this previous slide, so clearly these are individual files. What is the name of the file here? It's a centroid file for these two. And what is the name of the file here? That's a centroid file for these two. Showing centroids in terms of, you know, 0.35 times the word this plus 0.79 times the word that to users is a great way of making them realize that you have no clue how to make topic hierarchy. Okay, so in fact, there's a nice little research problem there, not necessarily research, but nice little problem there as to how would you provide a common description for a huge group of documents. You could find, for example, you could find frequently occurring keywords in those documents. And you could use that to define. See, when Yahoo makes this, Yahoo says, this is all, this is entertainment, this is sports, this is science. Now they made that name for it. Now you should be able to figure out, you know, when you make it automatically, you should be able to find a synopsis of a set of documents. Google has it easy because it only provides the synopsis of a single document, and all that it needs to do is show the pieces of text around the place where your query words are occurring. Now, Vivissimo, for example, does clustering-based retrieval, right? So it does provide some idea as to what each cluster is supposed to be. What they do normally is they take frequently occurring keywords and give it to you. So what would be the best way to describe it is not obvious at all. Okay. And the paper, basically, which you must read, compares a set of algorithms, k-means, bisecting k-means, and variations of hierarchical agglomerative clustering on a set of text data using, you know, both internal measures of consistency, what are the intra-cluster tightness and inter-cluster dissimilarity, and also external measures such as entropy. And their results essentially are that bisecting k-means does just quite well. In their data. So that's a data point to consider, which makes you kind of feel good that at least you know one of the good algorithms. But the bad side is that they only compare hierarchical agglomerative clustering and k-means, and there are like a million other algorithms, many of which are very costly, thankfully. So probably many of them are not run on text data. K-means winds up being the method of choice because it's easy to understand, easy to run. Okay. Per iteration cost is quite low. That's all about clustering. I just want to mention a couple of things even further beyond the things that we talked about, which might make sense given our discussion. One is, how does things like LSI help in clustering? Well, why should things like LSI help? Because I like LSI and it should help everywhere. And one idea is actually to say that the way you define the distance should probably be defining the similarity between documents in the right space. That's what LSI is telling you. Remember, query is a document. other documents are documents. And the whole point of latent semantic indexing is, if you compare them in the base space, you think certain things are not close to the query. Whereas if you compare them in the right space, you would realize that, you know, things which are actually relevant are relevant in terms of distance measure. So that idea, if it makes sense there, it should make sense in clustering too. So cluster, so first do latent semantic indexing, get rid of some of the lower eigen dimensions, lower singular vectors. So you reduce the dimensionality of the data. So if it was 1,000 dimensional data, you just reduce it to 7 dimensions. Okay. When you do that, in essence, you get rid of noise, and you also capture some of the linear combinations, linear dependencies between correlated attributes. Now, in that space, do clustering. Okay? Using, of course, the same distance measure of vector similarity. So now you have shifted your text data in original coordinate frame into a different coordinate frame, and then got rid of some of the unnecessary dimensions. And then basically you're basically clustering in that subspace. So it's like both a projection of the data into a subspace, plus before that translation of coordinate frame, such that the coordinate directions actually capture the variance in the data. And if you do that, you are likely to find better clusters than without that, because it'll be costlier. Okay? There used to exist a good search engine called Manjara, which was one of the first search engines to do clustering of documents that they're showing you. And it would use this idea. And to do this, of course, they have to do singular value decomposition at the query time. Singular value decomposition is n cubed. So these guys are theory folks. They found nice approximations to singular value decomposition, which can be done in linear time. And they use that. Yes, sir?
When did you LSI remove some information?
So the idea is sometimes it's good to lose the noise. Noise is also part of the data. And if you lose noise, that's actually a feature. Okay? So the reason LSI oftentimes works is because the way you projected the data, you're projecting the data into the right subspace, and the clusters are more obvious there. And the fact that clusters can be seen better if you project them correctly is something that you can understand quite easily. In three dimensions, you know, if I have a bunch of points in three dimensions, in 3D they may be, depending on the side you look into, they might actually be looking, and so for example, the entire point of eclipse. You know, when eclipse happened, it's not that the moon went to sun. It's just that on a particular projection, you know, they are in the same line. Now, if you want to cluster, you better not see in that side. You have to see it from the other side. Then you realize, oh my God, sun is so far away from moon. That's basically in three dimensions. If you project the points correct to the correct dimensions, you can see their spread much better. And some of that is what LSI is doing. Okay? We went with, of course, that you can change the distance measures. We went with vector similarity-based distances. Okay? Now, vector similarity-based distance is the edge of a bunch of foolish decisions we made. First of which was, let's take all the words in a document, put it in a big bag, and say that's the document. Okay? But the word order matters, and the bags, two documents having the same bag are not the same document. We knew this, but we did that anyway. And you can improve the distance measures based on phrasal analysis. Let's not talk about just single words. Let's talk about contiguous pieces of text that is similar between two files. And that's basically improved distance metrics between text documents. There's a lot of research in that. For example, you might take suffix tree, common suffix trees between different documents, or common shingles, which is contiguous pieces of text in different documents, and use that as a measure for distance. If you do that, obviously you'll find a different clustering because you change the notion of distance. Now, clearly this distance is a better distance for text documents than this one, than any of the other ones, vector space similarity type ones. We use those because those are cheaper, not because they're right. These are costly, so we don't use it. Okay? And then finally, we also looked at all this time we were talking about content-based distances, but you can do distances based on links. And we did that. Actually, we actually did clustering. I mean, we did link analysis. Whenever we did link analysis, page rank, etc., you could use the same link analysis to find clusters of documents that are densely connected to each other. That's the way you look for social networks in the web, finding tightly connected subgraphs of a large graph. It's a big, humongous, interesting problem. Scientists are probably interested in trying to find out who are all the CIS is talking to. FBI is interested in finding out who are all the terrorists talking to. Okay, so either way, you're looking at link analysis. Link-based clustering is where the distance measure changes. The clustering algorithm remains the same. Now the distance is in terms of hyperlinks that are shared rather than in terms of the words that are shared. Okay, we'll end here. We'll start next class with a variation called classification, where you are given the labels. You're saying that these are all supposed to belong to cluster. There are only two clusters. These all belong to cluster called positive cluster. These are all supposed to belong to negative cluster. Now tell me a function which, when given a new point, will tell me right away which cluster is supposed to fall into. And that's classification, and it winds up being very useful. In fact, in particular, that's the way Amazon tells you you should be buying this other book too, because previously you bought all those books, and look, you know, you should really buy this book too. Because based on my model of your buying habits, this is something you would like. Okay? So we'll talk about text classification next. Thank you.